This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, Tisha Week. In past months, several fatal drunk driving incidents made the news here in Malaysia. So we're just looking at the question of when does a drink turn into one too many and from there into an addiction. So that's what we'll be looking at today on our episode of Mind Matters together with Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, consultant psychiatrist from University Malaya Medical Center, as well as Associate Professor Dr. Simon Adamson, director of the National Addiction Centre, all the way from University of Otago in New Zealand. And Dr. Simon is also a visiting professor here in University Malaya, am I right?
Correct.
Yes, okay. So welcome to the show, Dr. Amir and Dr. Simon. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
So the issue of alcohol addiction, we'll be looking at, you know, when does a drink turn into being dependent on one? When does it turn into addiction? And then from there, how do we treat the addiction and the challenges on the long road to rehab and recovery? But Dr. Simon, perhaps I could start with you because it'd be interesting to look at the work that you do with the National Addiction Centre. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Certainly, our centre is a clinical research unit. We're all joint clinical academics, so we're psychologists and psychiatrists, and our mission has been to try and improve the quality of the addiction workforce in New Zealand directly so we can help patients with alcohol and drug problems and also try and positively influence government policy, because we know that's a really important part of achieving good outcomes, the background policies.
And now, what would you say are some of the, you know, significant inroads or achievements that you've made through your research?
We've been able to identify some effective interventions around alcohol dependence using a motivational interviewing approach. We've looked at the high rates of co-occurrence of mental health problems, particularly depression amongst people who are heavy drinkers, and looked at some of the treatment strategies used for that. We've also done quite a lot of research in the opioid area, so things like heroin and the treatment of that.
Do we have anything similar here in Malaysia, Dr. Amir, a research centre like that?
Yep. So the, in a way, the sister research centre, if you want to say it, in Malaysia is the one that I belong to, the University of Malaya Centre for Addiction Sciences in the University of Malaya. It's one of the first, but now there are a number of other similar research centres in, I think, about one or two other universities locally. And again, similarly, they do some work in terms of research on addiction, but the one that we have a bit of an advantage of is because the team that populates our research centres are mainly clinicians coming from either family medical specialists or psychiatry, and therefore we have a clinical focus in the work that we do in our centre. So similarly as well, we not only do research, but our main objective is also to translate that research into policy. And within the University Malaya Centre for Addiction Sciences, or UMCAS, as we call it, our main focus initially had been on opioids. But as the direction of addiction in Malaysia has shifted more towards amphetamine, we have quite a number of amphetamine researchers in it. And of course, my own tobacco group is in that particular centre. And we also have researchers looking at alcohol use disorder, and also behavioral addiction. So as I've shared before, last year, we've had, we've got some research looking at things like smartphone addiction, internet addiction, and also to a small level, a bit about gambling. So a little bit of a mix just to provide some opportunities and also to provide some data for the country. And we work very closely with the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education and other ministries relevant to assist them in policy development particularly.
And because we're focusing on alcohol today, how significant is alcohol addiction in the bigger picture of substance abuse in Malaysia?
Well, I think in globally, it's definitely a big player. And I think Simon can probably talk a little bit more about that. But in Malaysia, our main addiction, as you know, is going to be on tobacco or nicotine addiction. These are the two licit addictions that are available. But we must not forget that despite alcohol not being a major problem in Malaysia, it is still a problem if we allow it to not be addressed at all. And some of the work that we've done particularly looks at our friends and family on the Sabah and Sarawak end, which are often having a little bit more problems with their alcohol use. But also here in the peninsula, we're looking at mainly things like access to service is what the kind of work that we do over here. So there is definitely an opportunity to still do some work in this area and provide some level of leadership to assist relevant ministries to come up with good guidelines and policies for the rakyat.
I mean, Dr. Simon, looking at your experience in New Zealand and as well as what you know of global efforts, what are the consequences if, as a country, we don't look at alcohol addiction more seriously?
When you look at the current rates of alcohol problems in Malaysia, as Amir has said, numerically they're relatively low. But what we see internationally is an increasing globalisation trend. And whilst legal drugs don't have some of the problems that illegal drugs do, they have one very big problem, and that is they have large, powerful corporates who have a lot of money in PR and advertising to try and promote those products. So I think Malaysia needs to be very careful about any efforts to grow the alcohol market in Malaysia. The fact it's a relatively small problem is a good thing.
And, right.
It wouldn't necessarily stay that way if the government isn't careful about the policy settings.
So, I mean, what are the, you know, red flags that the government should be looking out for?
I would be, I'd be very careful about the advertising regulations. So the more corporations are allowed to advertise alcohol, the situation in Malaysia is drinking problems are protected to a large extent by the prevalence of the Islamic faith, and so it's going to be hard for the alcohol industry to peddle too much alcohol consumption amongst a large portion of the population. But we shouldn't take it for granted that therefore makes Muslim Malays safe from alcohol, because people do make poor decisions sometimes, and the alcohol industry would be very happy if Malaysia liberalised to the extent that that Muslims started to drink and started to drink in larger volumes.
Actually, Dr. Amir, I was thinking about that, and because culturally and because of religious factors, access to alcohol and our societal attitudes towards alcohol is very different from, say, a Western country like New Zealand. Yep. But does that mean that perhaps we may have blinkers on when it comes to identifying alcohol abuse as a problem?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, even in the National Mobility Health Survey, it's not that. When you look at the alcohol prevalence in Malaysia and you break them down according to ethnic groups, it's not like a whole population that is not supposed to drink does not report drinking. So there is, but it's just very, very small. But I think what's important is for us just to be aware that, if we don't have this open discussion about it, that there are certain things that we will miss out. Yeah, for example, alcohol harm awareness. I mean, we must not assume that drinking alcohol is harmless. Secondly, it's about the alcohol complications towards societies. Even though I might not drink, but if my neighbors are drinking and they don't know their limits and the harms that might happen, they might interfere with my well-being as well. And therefore, it's not just about you drinking, I'm not drinking. It's about us having that conversation to make sure that whoever is drinking, because they might be allowed to drink in a responsible manner to avoid complications for the rest of us living in this country. Then, of course, there's the issue of we have to be aware that for some people who do drink, they're going to have complications from it. One of them, of course, is an addiction problem. And therefore, these individuals, despite best efforts to stop, will not be able to stop. And therefore, we should be humane enough to at least lead them to the right place to seek that treatment. So, definitely we need to be open about this idea that there are going to be some people drinking. We probably think that none of us do drink because we're in Malaysia, but there are. And we need to then address we need to be open enough to address these issues and make sure that people who do drink, drink safely, and they don't have complications from that drink.
And alcohol use exists on a spectrum, you know, because as you've said, there's some, there's sort of casual or recreational drinking. And then, you know, how does it slide into dependence and addiction, Dr. Simon?
Well, if we can define that continuum just briefly and then talk about how people might progress. So amongst drinkers, we will have some people who can drink in a low-risk way. There isn't a no-risk level of alcohol consumption. Even small amounts of alcohol have slight negative impacts on people's health. But by medical consensus, there are some definitions around what constitutes low-risk drinking, where people might be able to drink up to a few days of the week with several days of the week of not drinking to intoxication on the days that they do, and not consistently drinking enough that over all of those days it adds up to quite a high load within the body. So that's that low-risk drinking pattern. We then get people who are drinking in a heavier way. They're not experiencing any problems yet, but because of that consumption level, we know that statistically they're at increased risk of physical health complications like cardiovascular and cancer, liver damage being the key three areas,
mm-hmm.
and they're at increased risk of intoxication-related injuries and other negative consequences. We then move up to people who are starting to experience problems in their lives, but don't necessarily have any discontrol around that. They're just, I guess, being a little irresponsible around their alcohol consumption. We then move into the lower end of the addiction scale where people start to have some loss of control. Addiction's not an all or nothing. A core part of addiction is that people have diminished control over their substance use. It doesn't mean zero control, and it doesn't mean other people have perfect control,
mm-hmm.
but it's where they start to move into struggling to limit how much they have, and the less control people have, the heavier their consumption gets, and the more other problems start to occur. They get physiological changes as part of alcohol just becoming a regular part of their bodily experience, and their body feeling uncomfortable without it, and a range of social and psychological negative consequences around employment and relationships and so on.
Mm. So then the next question that leads to is, you know, what puts a person at risk from, you know, travelling down that continuum, and, you know, what makes a person more likely or become addicted to alcohol and the other person not, perhaps. It's something that we will visit when we come back from the break. I'm speaking to Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, consultant psychiatrist from University Malaya Medical Center, and Associate Professor Dr. Simon Adamson, director of the National Addiction Center in University of Otago, New Zealand. He's also a visiting professor in University Malaya and visiting KL. For this short period. So when we come back, that question, how do you go from one end of the continuum to the other? We'll be right back, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik, and with me in the studio, Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, consultant psychiatrist from University Malaya Medical Center, as well as Associate Professor Dr. Simon Adamson, director of the National Addiction Center in the University of Otago in New Zealand. And Dr. Simon is also a visiting professor here in University Malaya. This is our Mind Matters series, and we're looking at alcohol addiction today. But in fact, Dr. Simon, before the break, you talked about alcohol use as a continuum. We're going from low risk drinking. There's no such thing as no risk. Any amount of alcohol consumption carries with it some risk. So we're going from low risk alcohol consumption and all the way to addiction. So then, you know, where is the point where somebody can say, I recognize, or, you know, this kind of drinking or this pattern of drinking is going to, you know, just make me slide a little further down the continuum. Are there risk factors that predispose somebody to an addiction?
there are a range of risk factors. So when we look at what causes addiction, addiction as a disorder is defined as a complex disorder. So in medicine, this is disorders that have a wide range of determinants. So it's not just a single infection or gene or injury that causes this illness. With addiction, we know around about 50% of what determines whether or not a person develops addiction is genetic. And it's a very wide range of genes. It's important to say these aren't faulty genes. It's not that someone's got something wrong in their genetic makeup. It's just there are certain personality, metabolic and other physiological influences that can all just add up to changing a person's odds. So the three of us having this conversation, we've all got some of those so-called addiction genes. It's just, you know, do we have a few or do we have a lot in terms of determining the risk?
Mm.
We see this in families where if there is a strong family history of addiction, we know that the children in that family have themselves an elevated risk of addiction. Even when they get adopted into separate families, it's their genetic influence, not the substance use of the adoptive family that is the stronger determining factor there.
So
genetics is a big factor. It's about half. That leaves another half of the explanation still to be provided.
Right.
And that
I
is,
thought you would have the answer.
That's right. And that's everything else. So those are the environmental factors. The environment starts in the womb. The environment is your family environment. It's the school you go to. It's the peers that you make friends with. There's just some luck in some of that happening. It's the country you live in. It's the policy settings of those countries. It's the exposure to advertising and encouragement. It's all of those factors. So they all contribute together. And we know that one of the big factors, Shawik, that I think is really important to identify with addiction is socioeconomic deprivation. In fact, alcohol is an interesting disorder. Alcohol misuse is an interesting disorder in that there's what we call a be technical for a second, a bimodal distribution. There's a higher rate of problems amongst poorer people, but then the rate goes down as people become more financially comfortable. But once people become quite financially comfortable, the rate goes up again. So people who are wealthy have their own set of risks around substance use problems. So as you see, this again reinforces this is a complex disorder. So a range of factors can influence that.
Dr. Amir, are we particularly concerned about the risk in younger people?
I think we're concerned about the risk in every person. Young people, the issue is about access. As you mentioned just now, we're a bit protected in terms of the age limit, in terms of the culture of drinking in this country, in terms of the price of alcohol beverages, at least the legal alcohol beverages.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem will be in communities where maybe they would have homemade type of alcohol beverages. That might be one issue, and especially if the adults in that particular community might not be as aware about the harms of early alcohol exposure. So that's where some of these particular problems will happen. But again, they're not across the whole of the country. They're going to be in certain communities, which I personally believe that we can then assist by targeted approaches to help. So it's a little bit different in terms of that. And I think in terms of even the alcohol use among young people, it also depends on where they're living. There might be a little bit more in the cities because of exposure. But at the same time, I remember when I was in high school, in university, early university actually, in foundation courses, that there were people, even from the rural communities, that were exposed to drinking as well, but it's just that it's not as common as we were exposed when we were living in the cities. So definitely the place that you were brought up might make a little bit of a difference. But personally, I don't think it's a major issue with young adults, young people yet. But again, this is where I said that we need to be at least careful that it does not become an issue moving forward. And most of the issues that we're seeing, even in clinical practice, will be, as Simon had mentioned, actually, you're right, we will get the ones who can afford alcohol beverages to have problems with their alcohol and might not know it. These are professionals who might be drinking at home more than they should be. And eventually their family members might bring them to see us for access. I don't often see the middle group having problems unless they've started to go for the cheaper alcohol beverages. And that one has its own risk, as we know. The alcohol limits are more, the alcohol is a bit more probably dangerous and causes more complications physically as a result.
So then, like you said, there are people who could be drinking perhaps at home or perhaps even in social settings and without realizing yep. that they're drinking more than they should or yep. Showing patterns that... So what does alcohol addiction actually look like?
Yeah, so I think first of all, because I studied quite a long time overseas and my exposure towards the alcohol awareness is very much different from what I'm seeing as a clinician in Malaysia for more than a decade actually. Like I said just now, it's about a bit of culture. We were introduced quite early about what is a standard unit in New Zealand where I trained quite early on. So you'd know that this would be roughly a standard unit, right? So often a rule of thumb would be a can of beer is one standard unit. Now, a can of wine, if you had the same level, is not a standard unit, right? Mm-hmm. So wine is about 100 mils equals to one standard unit. And then a liquor, again, is not the same as wine or beer. It's about 30 mils. So knowing this first is probably the first step of actually knowing that what you're drinking in a day might or might not be more than you should. Then second is knowing what is, in a way, a level that might research has shown to cause less harm. I won't say no harm, but less harm. And again, different countries have different policies. Sadly for us, we don't have a limit in Malaysia. We didn't put a limit in the limited guidelines that we do have about alcohol use. But the one I use is New Zealand. So it's about 2 standard units for women per day and 3 for men. So actually, you're allowed to have a maximum of 2 cans of beer at least for women and 3 for men, or probably 2 shots for women and 3 for men. Percent unit, and you've got to have at least 2 rest days in between this. So it's not drinking every day. It's there's got to be a few rest days in between, and it's about 10 per week or 15 per week for women and men respectively. So knowing those numbers itself allows individuals to be a bit aware about their drinking. So people who are not aware of these numbers and now are drinking at home because they can afford it, for example, might drink a whole bottle of whiskey in, say, 2 days. And if we look at the bottle as 750 mils and we take 30 mils as 1 cent a unit, we know that they've drank more than they should. Similarly with beer, if they're drinking like 6 cans of beer per day because they can and no one's stopping them and they don't know their numbers, then again, they can get into complications if they do this regularly. So these are just some of the issues. And as we know with addiction, the concept is the same for alcohol, where you're going to have certain themes. You know, you have like what Simon said just now, discontrol. You're going to have issues with compulsive use. You're going to have problems with physiological changes. And one of them is what we call tolerance, where you first one drink might cause you to have a bit of a buzz, and then that one drink is not enough, so you step up. And eventually, if you don't know your numbers, that's when you will have some complications, and when you decide to stop, you're going to have some withdrawals. And some of the withdrawals can be quite fatal with alcohol, particularly if you're down the spectrum of addiction.
Can you talk a little bit about the withdrawal, Dr. Simon?
Yes, so withdrawals is a relatively severe symptom, so many people with drinking problems will not experience this or might only at a very mild level. A typical withdrawal syndrome is where when a person stops drinking after they've been consistently drinking for a long period of time, and certainly in the last several days being most important, they stop drinking. The next day they start to feel uncomfortable. By day 2 they can be particularly uncomfortable. People will experience shakes, particularly the hands they tend to notice. They will sweat, hot and cold flushes. feel nauseous and a drop in their mood, so they can feel quite sad. The two most severe symptoms, however, are delirium tremens. So people become delirious. They, you know, they're confused about who they are and what's going on, withdrawal seizure. So people can have a seizure a bit like an epileptic fit. This is life-threatening. So for alcohol withdrawals, it is taken as a very serious medical circumstance. As I say, at the milder end, people aren't likely to experience that. And even heavier drinkers, there are many heavy drinkers who won't experience these seizures. There's a small proportion of heavy drinkers who do. And if they've had one before, they're very likely to have one in future. And if a person is having their first period of abstinence after heavy drinking and we don't know if they're prone to withdrawal seizures, we need to treat that very seriously.
Okay. And Dr. Amir, you talked about amounts, maximum amounts that would be considered acceptable in a day. But, you know, with addiction, and of course, there's got to be consistency to it. What if somebody is binge drinking just for a few, couple of weeks and then stops after that and perhaps only picks this up a few months down the road? Where is that on the continuum?
Yeah, so again, you know, what we're talking about is people who regularly drink, and there are certain numbers that have been, at least research has shown, has less risk. Not to say no risk, but less risk. But at the same time, you're right, there are certain patterns of drinking which are probably problematic, and binge drinking being one of them. And often it's cited as being more than 6 standard units per sitting. So if you, you know, if you're drinking like 7, technically you're binging. And if you look at the data by the NMHS 2015, the concerning part about that data is the way that we drink in Malaysia appears to be binge drinking. I think 60% of respondents reported that they tend to drink in that binge drink fashion. Mm-hmm. So that's unhealthy, because binge drinking itself can cause acute intoxication, and this can cause complications physiologically and also socially. You know, you're going to make poor judgments, particularly if you did not know that you're not supposed to drink and drive, which you're not supposed to drink and drive. That's the first public service announcement I'm going to make. Mm-hmm. But the second one is that you're going to cause a lot of stress to the system because of your acute intoxication. And sometimes people can actually get, medical complications as a result of that. So that's the first thing that we want to put across. But at the same time, like I said, if you're regularly drinking, you still need to know your numbers, because, you know, you might not know that you're not supposed to drink daily, right? So then you're going to get complications like what Simon had mentioned, liver cirrhosis, slow developing problems that you might not see at the very beginning. In fact, if you do blood levels, and this is sometimes patients come and say, "Doc, you know, my liver function test looks normal." Well, you might not have enough liver left to show abnormality, yeah, because your liver is already cirrhotic, because you need the cells to break down to show that level. So, you know, you need to then do other investigations to make sure. And of course, you've got physical symptoms that come out. But just, you know, just seeing the numbers itself, knowing the history, might not really show the true picture. And I think what Simon mentioned just now is really important, because for those who are having problems drinking, once they withdraw, the withdrawal symptoms are very, very important, both to assist in quitting if they decide to, but at the same time for safety reasons, because delirium tremens has a high risk of death, actually, if untreated. And therefore, individuals who, you know, have listened to this show and then felt like, "Oh my God, my drinking is a lot," you know, if you're starting to develop these symptoms of withdrawal once you've stopped your drinking, and you feel that it's starting to become really difficult, don't try to continue doing it at home. You know, seek professional help, because delirium tremens often happens about day 3, 4, 5 after you've stopped that last drink. Mm-hmm. But often people will reinstate at day 1 or 2 because they just can't bear the withdrawals of the shakes, for example, the sweating, you know, that really uncomfortable feeling. But if you decide to persevere, delirium tremens can happen at around day 3, 4, 5. So do come and see somebody, one of us at least, so that we can actually assist you in going through those withdrawal symptoms in a more safer fashion.
Thanks, Amir. And if I could just add a comment too, just around this discussion around what problematic drinking looks like. You know, I know from a lot of my clients will come and say, I'm not alcoholic because, and there'll be a variety of reasons that they sort of feel they're off the hook.
Such
I'm not
as?
Alcoholic because I don't drink every day. Mm. I'm not alcoholic because I don't drink spirits, because I still hold down my job. I do everything I need to, because I can get up in the morning, because I'm successful. There are a lot of reasons people can reassure themselves that what they're doing is okay. By the time they come and see me, they are acknowledging there is a problem, but they don't see it as severe as it can be. So actually, you know, identifying someone who drinks every day, all day, and can't cope without it, that's pretty obvious. That's a severe drinking problem. You don't need to have a medical degree to, to identify that. But there are a lot of people who are quite heavy and problematic who still experience these risks of withdrawal syndrome, for example, who might drink quite, you know, they get home from work, they drink a bottle of wine over dinner, they have some whiskey afterwards, they go to parties on the weekend, they might have the odd day off here and there, they just feel like they're living a fabulous life and they're a fun person, but they can't cope without alcohol and they haven't really put themselves to the test of that. So, we, you know, sometimes it can be disguised in other ways. And the term addiction, you know, we use that a lot. It's the focus of our work. But we know that for the general population, sometimes that's a stigmatising or off-putting term. The diagnostic term for alcohol is alcohol use disorder, and it's actually a lot broader. So addiction is that more severe end. So people who have problematic drinking and that wider alcohol use disorder could all, you know, benefit from making some changes and seeking formal assistance to do so, even if they're not drinking every day, even if they still have a job. And so
because
on.
Being high functioning will mask the problems that they are actually facing with their consumption. And also, you know, I started off this show talking about some of the fatal drunk driving incidents that have happened here in Malaysia. But really, that's sort of already when a problem has gone too far. And in a way, it's the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? If you were to look beneath it, there are probably a lot more people, as you said, Dr. Simon, going through, you know, alcohol use problems where they think that, well, I can still drive, and that's sort of like where we want to be focusing our attention on. We have to go for a quick break. We're talking about, I won't say alcohol addiction then, alcohol use disorder, the sort of broader spectrum of alcohol consumption and its associated issues, with Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, Consultant Psychiatrist from University of Malaya Medical Centre, as well as Associate Professor Dr. Simon Adamson, Director of the National Addiction Centre, University of Otago in New Zealand. He's also a visiting professor in University of Malaya. Stay tuned, we'll be right back, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. In the studio with me, Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, Consultant Psychiatrist from University of Malaya Medical Centre, as well as Associate Professor Dr. Simon Adamson, Director of the National Addiction Centre, University of Otago, New Zealand, and a visiting professor with University of Malaya. In our Mind Matters segment today, we are looking at alcohol use disorder. Dr. Amir, before the break, you started to go into, you know, you've talked about the complications and issues related to withdrawal from alcohol. And you said, you know, it's not something that you want someone to be attempting to do on their own. Yeah. You know, looking at the process of quitting alcohol, should somebody decide to make that step. You hear of people trying to go cold turkey as well because they think that's the best way to do it. And, you know, what are the risks of that? And what should the treatment process actually look like if they were to go through it in a proper manner?
Yep. So, I mean, there's definitely two levels. You know, the ones that we often see is going to be at the end of the spectrum. They are heavily, you know, if you're using the proper terminology, alcohol use disorder severe. Yeah, so these people are probably drinking much more than the standard units. Once they stop, they will have withdrawals almost immediately. The withdrawals are very uncomfortable. They will reinstate very quickly. They might try once or twice. It's just unbearable. They don't want to continue. They just continue drinking. Now, for some reason, they might get sick, they might get admitted, they might, you know, they might not have access, then suddenly they will have severe withdrawals, which can cause severe complications, the one that we discussed just now. So for these individuals, there are two phases in their treatment. One is to get what we call medical detoxification, where we definitely try to assist them to go over the period where we would expect delirium tremens to happen. And then often after that, they would then go to a period of rehabilitation and recovery. And often that's going to be psychosocial in its aspects of care, but also sometimes with certain medications to reduce craving, but mainly psychosocial. But the acute detoxification period is going to be almost medical. It's probably going to be requiring an admission. There's going to be a high level of medical care that's going to be given to these individuals to prevent what Simon had mentioned just now, the seizures. Because the seizures, together with the delirium, which is an acute confusion as a result of the acute withdrawal of alcohol, can actually be quite life-threatening. So these individuals will require round-the-clock care for at least 3 days. You know, to be fair, Shaoik, you know, if somebody comes with alcohol detoxification, you know, I don't want to be on call during that time because really it's unpredictable how these individuals might react. You know, we've had people who have had what we call not only hand tremors, body tremors, whole tremors literally jumping off the bed that they require to have some level of chemical and physical restraint just to make sure that they're safe. You know, we don't want them to have injuries as a result of the sudden, these tremors that they're having. It can be that unstable. You know, their blood pressures can go up and down during that period of time where we're having nurses check them every 15 minutes. But thankfully, the withdrawal symptoms only last between 3 to 4 days. So the anxiety that people like me face when we're on call with these people will be at least about 3 or 4 days. Unless we have multiple number of people detoxifying in the ward, then it'll be consistent anxiety.
So it's an admission for 3 to 4 days?
But it's around there. The admission will be probably a bit longer sometimes, but up to about a week often. And this is just during that period. And once the period has, they've gone over that period, then the process of rehabilitation will start. And it's going to be often psychosocial. Because, you know, one of the things that we didn't share just now is people drink for many reasons, you know, and some of them might have a major mental health problem that might have triggered their drinking from the very beginning. Often anxiety or depression being the two major causes, we probably need to deal with that. Psychosocial, because it could be related to maybe family issues, and therefore we need to address that. And this is all addressed after the acute detoxification period, because if you don't address that, this individual might reinstate back again into this drinking pattern, you know? So there is that period. So that's one group. Then there's going to be a second group of people who are probably having problems with their drinking. They're not yet having alcohol use disorder severe. They probably have alcohol use disorder mild to moderate. So these people would probably go through a psychosocial intervention that you can do in outpatients. You know, we could probably limit the number of drinks. We could discuss with them other methods to address the issue. They might or might not need medication, but often more so than that, they'll probably need some level of psychosocial counseling support.
I seem to have jumped a step ahead, actually, because I think it's also important to sort of see how we can bridge that gap from somebody perhaps finally being able to recognize that they have a problem with alcohol use and, you know, then taking that step to seeking help. And how does that process usually look like, Dr. Simon? And, you know, as Dr. Amir mentioned earlier, what he's seen is a lot of family members bringing their relatives in. How would you say, we can get people to recognize it's a problem and to take the step to seeking help?
Well, we know that it's only a low proportion of the people who have an alcohol problem who do seek assistance. There are a lot of people out there who will just carry on with their lives, and this will be one of the struggles that they have. Some of the people who don't seek formal treatment are going to make positive changes on their own. And it's similar to, you know, sometimes we might wake up and think, I'm going to try and have a better diet. I'd like to lose some weight. I'd like to exercise some more. I should watch less TV.
Mm.
I should be more observant in my faith. There's things we don't do quite as well as we'd like, and we try and do better. And for some people, they might just decide, I'm probably drinking more than I should. And they're able to just dial that back and make some positive changes. And if they are quite mild, then it's entirely within their control to do that. If it's not meeting one of those problems, that meeting the needs of those problems Amir has talked about in terms of major anxiety or relationship conflict and so on, then they can do that without necessarily a lot else. People, when they do seek treatment, it is often through the concerns of family members that occurs. They might turn up saying, they've kind of been pushed in the door by someone else, or it might be their family who turn up with them or for them. They might be the first person to make contact. I don't know how it is in Malaysia, but I know in New Zealand it's mothers and wives more than it is other family members who take that step. It is often the women in our family who notice these things, who are brave enough to speak to it and go out and look for that help. So what we need to do obviously then is to make the help services flag them so people know where they are, what is available. People will often look online these days, so we need to have a web presence so people can see what services are and decide how to navigate it. And we've had this conversation, the three of us here today, about what alcohol use disorder is. The general population, understandably, don't know those details. If you have someone in your family with a drinking problem, you're not sure how severe is it, what should I do, what services are out there, how do I navigate it. Even when we work in those services, we're constantly unsure quite which services are still open and which ones are easy to access, which ones are best for this person or that person. We have a reasonable idea, but we don't have all the pieces. Family know even less than that. So we want to try and make the front door obvious, and we want it to be easily opened, and we want people to feel welcome when they come in. So I think there's a lot of things services can do to try and achieve that.
You mentioned often it's the wives and the mothers, and I guess there are psychosocial issues that predispose men to alcohol use disorder, but is there a gender bias in the way we look at this issue? And would women facing alcohol use disorder find it more difficult to acknowledge that they have a problem?
Well, I'll speak briefly about my experience from New Zealand. I can't say how that applies here, and I'd love to hear Amir's comments following that. So we know in New Zealand and internationally that most addiction problems are more prevalent amongst men than amongst women. And it differs country by country. I think when you look at our smoking rates between our two countries, that actually provides an interesting contrast. Very different rates between men and women in Malaysia. For every woman who smokes, there are 30 or 40 men who smoke. Whereas in New Zealand, we more or less have parity. And in fact, the highest risk population are women in our indigenous Māori population. Mm. But overall rates are higher for men. Lower rates for women is good and good for women, but when women do have addiction problems, it actually can make it harder. There's greater stigma around acknowledging that they have a problem. When they go to treatment services, if they are in the minority, they can feel uncomfortable in group settings. Our services don't tend to separate by gender as much as you might often have here in your country, and so women can feel uncomfortable in those settings. One of the reasons that can contribute to addiction is trauma, and for women that is often sexual trauma and domestic violence. And so for a woman to go to a service where there are a lot of men there, mm-hmm. can be exactly what they don't need,
mm-hmm.
and they're not going to turn up.
Mm-hmm.
So we do need to think about services meeting the needs of women differently to services meeting the needs of men, yes.
Well, similarly, like you said, it's going to be more men than women. For every 5 men that come, you might get a woman that comes in. But I think the risk is pretty much the same. It's just that women who have problems, particularly with alcohol, they put themselves at different type of risk compared to men. You know, men could have fights, for example. Women could be victims of sexual assault is what happens when you don't know your levels and you get yourself into bad places. But in terms of the problems with the alcohol use disorder severe, it's definitely going to be more men than women that we've seen, at least in clinical settings, both for outpatients and also inpatients.
Okay. You know, this conversation has gone on longer than I expected. But I think just very quickly, perhaps as a way for us to wrap up, how do we move forward? And not just in terms of, you know, after somebody has sought treatment, for instance, gone through the detox process and rehab and recovery, what's the outlook in terms of alcohol use disorder in their life? Is it something that they always have to be looking over their shoulder?
So I'll pass that to Simon for that. But I just want on our side just to mention that in Malaysia, help is available. I think that's the first thing. I've got many people asking, where can I find help? Is it available in Malaysia? Do I've got to go to Singapore? No, it's available in Malaysia as well. You could go to see your general practitioner. You could go to see your family medical specialist in a Klinik Kesehatan. You know, they actually have guidelines in detecting whether you have a problem or not. If you access the hospital-based services, in most of the addiction and also psychiatry side, you might at least be able to get some support there. So help is available, and we've also got Alcoholic Anonymous in Malaysia, if you didn't know that. And also we've got some private rehabilitation centres as well that might be able to help.
So my comments around what happens after treatment for people would be that for people at the who are quite mild, they may continue to drink at a low level if they've just needed to reduce their consumption. For people at the more severe end, if they're going to have a successful outcome, it's almost certainly will have been because they've stopped entirely and they're going to need to sustain that long term. There is always a risk of relapse, and people need to be aware of that. The treatment process should have armed people with the tools to know what their risks are and to try and prevent that. Family are really important as an ongoing support around this. And if I can just say to people who... successful addiction treatment often involves finding what we talk about as we paraphrase as substitute addictions, other things that people are passionate about that they feel really committed to. Sometimes it can be AA meetings, it can be sport, it can be their faith, it can be a variety of things, and people put their energy into that. People who undergo a successful recovery can actually be exemplary citizens. They can be a very positive part of our community, and I think as communities it's helpful for us to recognise that, because often our reaction to something that we think is immoral or bad is to shun people, and what we don't realise is we actually make it harder for them to be well again and more likely that they will experience problems. So we want to welcome people back into our community, celebrate the success of their change, and recognise they actually have a lot to offer the community and the wisdom they've gained from those life experiences.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, Consultant Psychiatrist from University Malaya Medical Centre, and Associate Professor Dr. Simon Adamson, Director of the National Addiction Centre in University of Otago, New Zealand, sharing their insights with us on alcohol use disorder. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.